for great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. I am flying solo today, but no worries. There is more than enough to get into. Before I do, I just want to offer a brief PSA. Again, this April 11th marks the four-year anniversary since the arrest of journalist and publisher Julian Assange. On April 11th of this year in Washington, D.C., activists and supporters from around the U.S. will be converging at 10th and Pennsylvania in Washington, D.C. from 4 to 6 p.m. in front of the Department of Justice to demand the charges against him be dropped. And what is happening to Julian Assange is, without hyperbole, happening to all of us. Daily, we see the increasing criminalization of telling the truth and, by extension, truth. So it's never been more vital to stand up for Julian Assange and demand that he finally be released. There's no case against him. There's never been a case against him. And he is being persecuted for the crime of journalism, which is not a crime. Journalism is not a crime. That said, let's get into what is happening in this increasingly crazy world of ours. And what better place to start than with the World Health Organization? On Monday of this week, the quadripartite, as it's called, was called to action for One Health for a Safer World. Now, One Health is a globalist agenda I've been talking about for quite some time, and it's something that I will explain again, detail again, as I go through this press release on the WHO's website from, again, the 27th of March. And this One Health agenda, this One Health framework, is what it seems like is going to be used to force the next so-called pandemic upon us, and then the one after that, and then the one after that, unless we stand up to this utter nonsense now and put an end to it. What happened on the 27th of March? Well, according to this press release at the WHO's website, recent international health emergencies such as COVID-19 pandemic, Mpox, which is monkeypox, but you can't call it monkeypox anymore because that's insulting to some buddies, and also, as it's been said, insulting to monkeys as well. So now it's officially Mpox. Recent international health emergencies such as COVID-19 pandemic, Mpox, Ebola outbreaks, and continued threats of other zoonotic diseases, food safety, antimicrobial resistance, or AMR challenges, as well as ecosystem degradation and climate change, clearly demonstrate the need for resilient health systems and accelerated global action. One Health is seen as the main approach for tackling these pressing and complex challenges facing our society. So, what One Health is, in terms of the next pandemic, in inverted commas, is a bringing together of so-called contagion, which does not exist, and food safety, antimicrobial resistance challenges, as well as the so-called climate crisis, climate change, which, as we all know, there's only one thing to blame for that, and it's carbon dioxide. So it's bringing together all of these invented and ginned up threats and linking them and saying that these all need to be addressed at once because you can't have one without the other. Therefore, as this press release says, One Health is seen as the main approach for tackling these pressing and complex challenges facing our society. On the 27th, it was the first annual face-to-face meeting of the heads of the quadripartite organizations working on One Health, and they issued an unprecedented call for enhanced global action. Now, what is the quadripartite? It consists of four main agencies: the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations, or FAO, United Nations Environment Program, UNEP, World Health Organization, WHO, and World Organization for Animal Health, or WOAH. So four globalist, global governance agencies came together to, for the first time, issue this call to action. In the call to action, the quadripartite leaders urged all countries and key stakeholders to promote and undertake the following priority actions. I want to emphasize all countries and key stakeholders to promote and undertake the following priority actions. The first one is to prioritize One Health in the international political agenda, increase understanding, and advocate for the adoption and promotion of the enhanced intersectoral health governance. The One Health approach should notably serve as a guiding principle in global mechanisms, including in the new pandemic instrument and the pandemic fund, to strengthen pandemic prevention, preparedness, and response. So the new pandemic instrument is the pandemic treaty that has received more and more attention, rightfully so. But again, I want to point out that that pandemic instrument is separate from the ongoing proposed amendments to the international health regulations, which, if we're looking at what will be binding on all countries and have an actual global governance effect on countries within a legal framework, it will be the amendments or proposed amendments to the international health regulations. I've spoken about this with independent journalist James Roguski many times. If you're not familiar with his work, do check it out at his Substack, jamesroguski.substack.com. He's constantly on this and has been for over a year now. And it's the proposed amendments to the international health regulations we really need to be paying attention to. But we should be keeping an eye on this so-called pandemic instrument as well, or the pandemic treaty, as it's referred to, which is not quite accurate, but that's become the common nomenclature. So the second call to action is to strengthen national One Health policies, strategies, and plans to foster wider implementation across relevant sectors and at all levels. So this is a call to action for implementing and strengthening the One Health agenda at the national level. So there's the global level and then the national level. This needs to be injected at the national level across relevant sectors and at all levels. The third call to action is to accelerate the implementation of One Health plans. So they want to get this going and in place as quickly as possible, accelerate the process, accelerate the global governance mechanism at work here. After that, the call to action, the fourth, is to build intersectoral One Health workforces that have the skills, capacities, and capabilities to prevent, detect, control, and respond to health threats in a timely and effective way. So build the infrastructure in terms of workers and entities comprised of those workers that will essentially enforce this One Health agenda. And we already see this at work with, for example, Bill Gates's germ team going around and looking for supposed contagion to gin up into a potential pandemic and something they can point at to say, this is going to be a threat. We need to preempt this, and we need to do it with so-called vaccines, therapeutics, and diagnostics, which is something I'll get to in a bit. The fifth call to action, strengthen and sustain prevention of pandemics and health threats at source, targeting activities and places that increase the risk of zoonotic spillover between animals and humans. Keyword there, targeting. And we should take note of zoonotic spillover between animals to humans. This is going back to the beginning of the COVID-19 operation and the wet market in Wuhan and the transfer somehow of a non-existent virus from a bat or a pangolin, or now raccoon dogs are in the picture, to a human being. This doesn't happen. It's never been proven to happen. There's nowhere in the scientific literature where you can find proof of this happening. Many claims that it happens, but when you look at what's been done scientifically to back up the claims, there's nothing that's been done that follows the scientific method to back up the claim. This is another scare tactic, just like gain of function, or better put, gain of fiction, which is not to say there aren't BSL labs with people in them tinkering with things, with proteins, with toxins. There certainly are, and there's billions that's gone to that, but they have no viruses to work with. They have no pathogens to work with. Lots of patents saying they are, but patents do not equal proof. And again, with regard to just SARS-CoV-2, nothing, whether from an animal transmitted to a human or from a lab transmitted to a human, has been isolated. It's not there. We need to remember that. This is a concocted scare. And this is why it's so important to realize it's concocted, because you have entities like this One Health agenda using the concocted scare to further expand and consolidate their control over the world and over every country in the world. The sixth call to action, and there are seven of them, so I'm almost done with this tiresome list. The sixth one is encourage and strengthen One Health scientific knowledge and evidence creation and exchange, research and development, technology transfer and sharing, and integrating of information and data, and facilitate access to new tools and technologies. So let me read that again, because it's very telling in a lot of ways. encourage and strengthen One Health scientific knowledge and evidence creation and exchange. Creation and exchange of evidence. Creation of evidence. Again, this is going back to making things up and using those made up things to create a global health scare based on made up contagion. All contagion is made up, and using that as justification to lock down the world, to inject people with lethal toxins, and to increase surveillance, and to do this on one level, but on another level, have an international monetary and financial system being recalibrated with this authoritarian control providing the containment of the world's population that is needed to recalibrate that international monetary and financial system. And I'll get into more of that in a little bit, but evidence creation. I was always taught that you find evidence, you don't create it, but they're showing their hand here, I think, with this language. And they're probably aware that they're showing their hand and they don't care anymore. They've long since stopped caring. Their approach is now we are going for this and you are going to suffer it come hell or high water. The seventh and final call to action is to, of course, increase investment and financing of One Health strategies and plans, ensuring scaled up implementation at all levels, including funding for prevention of health threats at source. I think that one is self-explanatory. More money is going to be funneled into this enterprise, this fraud. And of course, what that's going to serve to do, one of many things it's going to serve to do, is to impoverish and immiserate tens of millions, billions of people. This is a wealth transfer into a globalist agenda. This press release from the 27th of this month goes on to say, to further support countries and governments putting the One Health approach into practice, the quadripartite partners are developing an OHJPA implementation guide to be released in 2023. OHJPA is One Health Joint Plan of Action. So there's a guide coming for every country on Earth, and they're going to be expected, they're going to be told to start putting this One Health approach into practice. Now, there are four signatories to this call to action. The first is Ku Dongyu, who is the Director General of the FAO, and I'll get a bit more into him in a moment. Inger Andersen, Executive Director of UNEP. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, whom we all know quite well, unfortunately, at this point, who is the WHO's Director General. And Monique Eloui, who is the Director General of the WOAH. So, Tedros, I don't think we need to go into. We know who he is, what he's about, but Ku Dongyu is interesting, and him being a signatory to this shows, I think, that this whole idea that the East is splitting from the West is patently ridiculous. Something I've talked about many times, but here's yet more evidence. So who is Ku Dongyu, the Director General of the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations. Well, he took office on the 1st of August of 2019, which, think of that what you will, interesting timing, perhaps coincidental, perhaps not. And this is according to his bio on FAO.org. His cardinal principle is that, quote, problems can also be the source of progress, unquote, which is a nice way of saying that chaos breeds creativity, or destruction breeds creativity, creative destruction, which is a mantra of these globalists and their entities. This is another way of saying build back better. So that's his cardinal principle, according to his bio on the FAO's official website. Before coming to FAO, Qu served as China's Vice Minister of Agriculture and Rural Affairs, where one of his achievements was to promote inclusive and innovative development to make sure information and communication technologies were available in rural areas so that more than 400 million farmers could use their smartphones as a new farming tool. I did not know that smartphones constitute farming tools, but Qu has made such possible for 400 million farmers, allegedly, according to his bio. That vision has been consistent across a professional career that includes periods in central and local government, in and leading research institutes, and as a human resources leader at the China Three Gorges Project Development Corporation, a $40 billion investment project. Qu says he represents the combination of an, quote, Asian soul, unquote, and a, quote, global mind, unquote. Globalist par excellence. Qu has participated in multilateral initiatives such as the World Trade Organization and the G20, as well as numerous bilateral initiatives involving Asia, Africa, and Latin America. He has also directly helped design flagship South-South cooperation projects with FAO and the World Bank. So on one level in China, we have this guy working on huge investment projects that involve digitalization, bringing digitalization to farming, which we're supposed to take as a given, is a good thing. When we look at digitalization overall in China, we can see what kind of nightmare it's been for the people of China, whether we're talking about those who have to slave away making our digital products, or those whose lives are upended on the digital platforms they themselves use, something China is very fond of doing to its people when it wants to clamp down. And often, what does it use to clamp down? The threat of a so-called virus or so-called contagion. And it will tell the world that this has to do with the public health of the Chinese people, but it's not the case. It's never been the case. And we should scoff anytime we hear that from Xi or Qu or any of the heads of state who get up in Beijing or Shanghai or anywhere else in the world to tell us that they are optimizing, this is their latest word, optimizing their COVID-19 response for the benefit of their people. They're not doing anything for the benefit of their people, at least in that regard. So at the next level, outside of China, this guy Qu has been cozy with the WTO, the G20, and the World Bank, huge globalist institutions that are involved in the control of global finance to a massive degree. This is this guy's background, and he is one of the signatories to this call to action for the One Health agenda. So a bit more about the One Health agenda. I've gone over this several times, but it's worth going over again. At the WHO's website, you can find a page detailing the One Health high-level expert panel. At the top of that page, it reads, One Health stands for an integrative and systemic approach to health grounded on the understanding that human health is closely linked to the healthiness of food, animals, and the environment, and the healthy balance of their impact on the ecosystems they share everywhere in the world. These interconnections and vulnerabilities were once more demonstrated by the COVID-19 pandemic. Were they? No, but this is their narrative and this is what they're going with, and they intend to push it on all of us. This led the heads of FAO, UNEP, WHO, and WAH, whom I just listed, who met in November 2020 at the Paris Peace Forum, to further enhance their cross-sectoral collaboration by creating a multidisciplinary One Health high-level expert panel with the support of the governments of France and Germany. So in come the Western nations. And this is something that's long been in the works since at least 2020, if not before. And here we are in 2023, and the call is to accelerate this. Let's get this going. Now, who is on this One Health high-level expert panel? Well, I'll point out a few people of note. We have Casey Barton Beravesh, who is affiliated with the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We also have a gentleman named Osman Dar, who is a consultant in public health for Public Health England. He is the director of the One Health Project at Chatham House, Royal Institute of International Affairs in the UK. Chatham House is a globalist roundtable akin to Bilderberg, let's say, the Council on Foreign Relations, Club of Rome. They have their differences, of course, but this is at the same tier of the global public-private partnership. So we have this individual involved. We have the UAE coming in with Salama Al-Muhairi, who is Director of Veterinary Laboratories Division at the Abu Dhabi Agriculture and Food Safety Authority in the UAE. Many individuals from Africa are represented. India is in the mix, Bangladesh. And Bangladesh is notable because if we go to the proposed amendments for the international health regulations and the proposed amendment that crosses out essentially respect for human dignity in the implementation of the new regulations, the respect for human dignity and human sovereignty. Bangladesh that proposed that. So Bangladesh here represented on the One Health high-level expert panel by Nitish Debnath. He is the team lead of something called the Fleming Fund Country Grant to Bangladesh, DAI Global LLC, and he's the national coordinator of One Health Bangladesh. Further down the line, we have Qatar in the mix, we have New Zealand, and we have the only person on this panel who doesn't have a short bio listed. And who is he? Dr. George Fu Gao, head of the Chinese CDC, main participant in Event 201, and also an author of, a co-author of one of the first papers to claim that a novel coronavirus had been identified in China. And that is, it's not even a paper, it's a brief report at the New England Journal of Medicine, a novel coronavirus from patients with pneumonia in China, 2019. This was published online on January 24, 2020. And this claims preposterously isolation of SARS-CoV-2. But when you read through it, it's full of holes. No control experiments were done. And it relies on the nonsense of genomic sequencing, the magic of genomic sequencing, to try to convince us that a new and novel coronavirus was identified in patients presenting with pneumonia in China in late 2019. So he's part of this One Health high-level expert panel. Who else do we have? Well, we have Catherine Machalaba, who is a senior policy advisor and senior scientist affiliated with EcoHealth Alliance in the U.S. And we have Li Zhu, who is chief of branch for emerging infectious diseases at China's CDC. And among others, the last person I'll point out is Vyacheslav Smolensky of the Russian Federation, the deputy head of the Federal Service for Surveillance on Consumer Rights Protection and Human Well-Being, Rospotrebnadzor, which is essentially Russia's FDA, is a good comparison. And if you go back to last May and the meeting that was taking place at the WHO, with the amendments being proposed then to the international health regulations. And you can find this on YouTube. When it comes to Vyacheslav, who was present, and it came to him to make his statement, he said, "We're not on board with the amendments being proposed right now." And I'm paraphrasing, but you can find this on YouTube. It's also linked at one of the articles James Roguski did at the time. You can find it in the article he did summarizing what happened at that meeting or series of meetings. He said, "We're not on board with these proposed amendments at the time, but we are all in when it comes to this One Health globalist agenda." And indeed, they are. Russia is, China is, the US is, the UK is, Africa is, and this blows a hole in this idea that we're somehow seeing a multipolar world emerge. I'm not denying that we're seeing a multipolar world emerge, but that we're seeing one emerge in which we have the East, which is fighting against globalism, and the West, which is still standing for globalism. They're both still standing firmly with globalism. They have their differences, like board members of the same corporation, but at the end of the day, they're all about optimizing the performance of that corporation, sustaining that corporation. And that's a very good analogy that I must give credit to Ian Davis for putting forth. So this One Health is coming, whether we like it or not, or they're going to try to force it on us, whether we like it or not. But we need to be aware of this. Many people are becoming more and more aware of this. And we need to say no to this imposition upon humanity, this anti-human imposition upon humanity. And to further hammer home the global reach of this One Health agenda, we can go to the G20 Bali Leaders Declaration from last November. This was made in Bali, Indonesia, at the end of the annual meeting there. And it was signed off on by all members of the G20. Who are the members of the G20? Well, here in alphabetical order on the G20's own website, g20.org, Argentina, Australia, Brazil, Canada, China, France, Germany, India, Indonesia, Italy, Japan, Mexico, Republic of Korea, that's South Korea, Russia, Saudi Arabia, South Africa, Turkey, United Kingdom, United States, and the European Union. So 19 countries and the EU. And it's important to point out, as stated here on the G20's website, that the G20 members represent about 85% of the global GDP, over 75% of the global trade, and about 2/3 of the world population. So the convergence here, the intermingling here, the convolvement here of East and West, particularly through finance, through capital, huge numbers, 85% of the global GDP, 75% of global trade. These entities aren't in a hurry to break up anytime soon, if at all. And in fact, they're all about coming together, consolidating their power as much as they can. Yes, there are going to be differences, but it's never going to separate them at the expense of the international monetary and financial system. So we have ostensible enemies still very much together here, and they very much came together last November with the issuing of the G20 Bali Leaders Declaration. And in point number 22 of that declaration, it reads in part, "We remain committed to embedding a multi-sectoral One Health approach and enhancing global surveillance, including genomic surveillance, in order to detect pathogens and antimicrobial resistance," there it is, AMR again, "that may threaten human health. To enable global pathogen surveillance as part of our commitment to implement the IHR, or International Health Regulations of 2005, we encourage sharing of pathogen data in a timely manner on shared and trusted platforms in collaboration with WHO. We encourage sharing of benefits arising from the utilization of pathogens consistent with applicable national laws." So obviously, the One Health agenda is in there. They all agree upon it, according to this document. And they're all still committed to implementing the IHR, and whatever proposed amendments to the IHR are agreed upon. And with regard to the magic trick of genomic sequencing and surveillance, they're all in agreement of sharing that assembled data around the world and in collaboration with the WHO, which is exactly what helped kick off the COVID-19 operation. It was the in silico sequencing of genetic material cobbled together and presented as the genome of a so-called new and novel coronavirus that was shared on a global database, sent around the world, and has been used ever since to, in large part, help continue this COVID-19 operation. And again, it's all based on invented nonsense that we're supposed to take as contagion that does not exist. In point 23 of the Bali Leaders Declaration, We recognize the need for strengthening local and regional health product manufacturing capacities and cooperation, as well as sustainable global and regional research and development networks to facilitate better access to VTDs, which are vaccines, therapeutics, and diagnostics, as I mentioned earlier. Facilitate better access to VTDs globally, especially in developing countries, and underscore the importance of public-private partnership and technology transfer and knowledge sharing on voluntary and mutually agreed terms. We support the WHO mRNA Vaccine Technology Transfer Hub, as well as the spokes in all regions of the world, with the objective of sharing technology and technical know-how on voluntary and mutually agreed terms. We welcome joint research and joint production of vaccines, including enhanced cooperation among developing countries. We acknowledge the importance of shared technical standards and verification methods under the framework of the IHR 2005, again, the International Health Regulations, to facilitate seamless international travel, interoperability, and recognizing digital solutions and non-digital solutions, including proof of vaccinations. So here we are with the so-called vaccine passports. All G20 entities, 19 countries plus the EU, are on board with this. They also support continued international dialogue and collaboration on the establishment of trusted global digital health networks as part of the efforts to strengthen prevention and response to future pandemics that should capitalize and build on the success of the existing standards and digital COVID-19 certificates. So in their view, the last 3 years have been a smashing success, and we need to capitalize on those successes to both expand and consolidate and make more dense their control. And that's what they're going for. That's what this call to action earlier this week is signaling. And it's out there for any of us to find. We just have to go to these sites, do a little bit of digging, and read between the lines as to what these people are saying, investigate these people, who they are, what they've done in the past, and we can get a very good idea of what their plans are for the future. Pivoting from there, although not changing too much from the subject, also on March 27th, BioNTech, who's been in partnership with Pfizer to produce so-called mRNA injections to so-called inoculate us against so-called COVID-19, surprised analysts with low revenue guidance as COVID-19 vaccine demand wavers. This according to fiercepharma.com. So what's going on here? It sounds like bad news for BioNTech, but when we get into it, it's quite the opposite. So reading from this piece, after garnering worldwide acclaim over the past 3 years, thanks to its pandemic response, 2023 is shaping up to be an onerous period of change for BioNTech. And during the market metamorphosis, the company is warning investors of a serious sales slowdown. BioNTech generated global sales of 17.3 billion euros, about $18.7 billion last year, surpassing its own November guidance range of 16 billion euros to 17 billion euros. The German mRNA specialist expects to deliver just 5 billion euros, $5.4 billion in 2023 vaccine sales, quote, significantly below, unquote, current consensus estimates of at least 8 billion euros, according to Third Bridge analyst Lee Brown. The lackluster revenue prophecy reflects, quote, plummeting demand for population-wide levels of booster vaccinations, unquote, Brown added. Now, that is true. Fewer and fewer people want this poison anymore, and that is something to be celebrated and encouraged, and I would extend that to all injections, even the traditional so-called vaccines. One major crux of BioNTech's sales potential this year is the renegotiation of the German biotech supply contract with the European Commission, which, quote, has the potential to delay deliveries over multiple years or to cut the previously contracted volumes, unquote, Brown said. So this is getting into the problem with the EU that Pfizer, BioNTech, and the EU have run into regarding the negotiation of the provision of these injections to the EU, in which von der Leyen was exchanging texts with Albert Bourla, CEO of Pfizer. And that investigation is still ongoing. Some developments have emerged over this past week with regard to that. And that's something I'm going to try to get into on Monday with Issa Blumey. But just to flesh that out a little bit, what they're saying there, what this article is saying with regard to the renegotiation of the supply contract, BioNTech supply contract with the European Commission. Jens Holstein, who is BioNTech's chief financial officer, said, the year 2023, from our perspective, is a little bit of a transitional year in that respect, because there are still some doses with governments that we expect will be moved into the market, he told investors on a earnings call this past Monday. Quote, therefore, we expect further upside in the time to come thereafter, unquote. Meanwhile, as the pandemic eases and as governments stop funding large vaccine purchases, BioNTech and other companies are awaiting a shift to a private market model. So they're going to move into the private sector, and they expect to make gains there, which is why I said this isn't all bad news, or even bad news in any respect for BioNTech. Moving on in this article, BioNTech expects its first commercial market to open up in the U.S. sometime in the second half of 2023, according to the company's chief strategy officer, Ryan Richardson. Quote, it will likely take a few years to fully transition from pandemic to steady state market as this transition occurs in the midterm, unquote, he said. BioNTech is eyeing growth potential for its COVID shot franchise, driven by, quote, a continued shift to private markets globally if successful in ongoing trials, unquote, he added, singling out the company's next-gen COVID shot being developed with Pfizer. I don't think at this point anybody who's paying attention to what's been going on over the last 3 years has any illusions about actual trials being done. And all of us, I would say, are saying, what the hell is going on with a next gen COVID shot being developed with Pfizer? Who is going to submit themselves to this? Certainly some people will, unfortunately. And what the next gen COVID shot is comprised of, who only knows at this point, and we'll probably never know, just like we'll probably never know what fully is in the current iteration of Pfizer BioNTech's injections. Going on with this article, COVID-19 remained a major cause of hospitalizations and deaths last year. Yeah, okay, based on the PCR scam, outpacing levels typically caused by seasonal flu. So again, it's more of a threat than the so-called influenza virus. Despite the higher doses, the higher disease burden of COVID, however, administration of COVID shot doses lagged flu in the U.S. by approximately 27 million doses, Richardson explained. And here it's important to point out this push toward influenza that we've been seeing, particularly in the form of avian flu, which is continually being resurrected as a scare and has already been used to kill tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, of animals around the world, livestock, which has had a huge effect on the global food supply. And a lot of this culling has been based on a PCR test administered to a chicken presenting in a strange way. And the PCR test says, hey, presto, this chicken has avian influenza, H5N1. And therefore, we have to suspect that the whole flock is at risk, and so we have to kill them all. This is what they've been doing in many places in the world, and destroying the food supply, destroying businesses, agricultural businesses in the process. And this is also going to be used to justify the rollout of new flu injections. And unfortunately, I don't think a lot of people, when it comes to seeing through the scam of the last 3 years, are that hip when it comes to the flu and will dutifully line up to get the new flu shot, because that is still perceived in the public consciousness as a legitimate pathogen, a real pathogen, even though it's not and it's never been proven to be. And for anyone who doubts that, take a look at the Rosenau experiment from 1919 and similar experiments done thereafter, which provided the same results as the Rosenau experiments, to show that what is called the flu in that case, in that place and time, the Spanish flu, is not transmissible between human beings. It was unable to be done, despite going to the lengths of taking blood from people who were sick with the so-called Spanish flu and injecting it into healthy people. Those healthy people, not one got sick from that. Moving on here, quote, while overall volumes are likely to remain lower than flu in 2023, we believe that the disease burden, that is of so-called COVID-19, and relatively high vaccine efficacy support increased uptake over time, Richardson said. Taking a deeper dive into BioNTech's 17.3 billion euro revenue haul last year, 12.7 billion euros of that sum came from BioNTech's share of profits in Pfizer and Fosun Pharma territories, Fosun being a Chinese entity. Another 3.2 billion euros came from direct sales on BioNTech's turf, while the remaining 1.2 billion euros came from COVID sales to BioNTech's collaboration partners, the company explained. So, yes, there's going to be a significant drop for BioNTech, but that drop is going to be compensated for by moving to the private sector, predominantly to the private sector. They anticipate it's going to be compensated for by the next gen COVID shot they're developing with Pfizer. And who knows what they have in store in terms of flu injections. I haven't looked at their pipeline recently, but I know Moderna's is chock full of supposedly mRNA-based flu injections. And I say supposedly because, well, we're told that's how these injections work. It's never been shown yet that their modified RNA is able to enter a human cell and create the so-called spike protein that is the most toxic agent of the alleged SARS-CoV-2 viral particle. And in fact, the spike protein itself has never been isolated from nature. It exists only as a laboratory construction. Lots more I could go into here, but I think it's very clear how this global operation has rolled out and is continuing to roll out, and the maniacs behind it have no intention of stopping anytime soon. So let's stay frosty in that regard and say no to all of their madness. That's it for me today. I'll be back at the same time on Monday. Thank you very much for listening to me. Much appreciated. And stay tuned for Joe Hoft up next here on TNT Radio.